Hello and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your weekly libertarian take on news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. If you're tired of the choices offered by today's politics, you have come to the right place. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my illustrious colleagues, Catherine Mengi Ward and Matt Welch. And we have a very special guest. You know him as the host of Free Media. I know him as Dungeon Master. We rolled a natural 20 to have him here today. It is Reason's very own Robbie Suave. Everybody say hello.
Howdy.
I am delighted to be here. Nice to be with all of you. It's a great news that Rising's taping schedule got a little bit earlier, which means I wake up way too early, but I'm available to fill in on the Reason Roundtable, which warms my heart.
Perfect. Like I said, it was a critical role. Matt Welch.
Indeed.
Hello.
Oh, hello.
All right. Happy Monday to all of you and happy every single day for the rest of forever to the guys who made South Park. South Park creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone, who just signed a deal with Paramount for a reported $1.5 billion. To put that in context, the Doge cuts to public broadcasting were $1 billion, and people were really mad about that. This deal is for five more 10-episode seasons of South Park. That's 50 episodes. Works out to about $30 million per show by my journalist math. And they celebrated with a scene roasting both President Trump and Paramount. Robbie, I want to start with you. I know you follow media, you cover media. Put this in context for us. Why is this deal important? And what does it tell us about the current media environment, especially given the recent news that Stephen Colbert, who was mentioned in that segment on South Park, that Stephen Colbert's show was going to be canceled? What does this all mean?
Right. It's important because there's a lot of concern from liberals and also just, you know, people who don't love every single thing Donald Trump represents, that his penchant for tweeting or truthing, I guess, as we call it on Truth Social, constantly about how much he hates any and all criticism in mainstream media or anywhere is not just criticism, but is he also files lawsuits, sued George Stephanopoulos for defamation, got mad at 60 Minutes over how they edited the Kamala Harris interview.
Which is why they paid the $15 or $16 million toll, right?
Exactly.
They probably had a good legal case, but they were just like, we want this merger to go through.
The point of that is the federal government, contrary to my wishes and probably the wishes of everyone here, has some power over whether private market actors can merge, acquire other businesses. We have, you know, a Federal Trade Commission to oversee those kinds of things, and an FCC and an FEC and all sorts of government bureaucrats who can get in the way of having these companies merge. And so then the question becomes, does Paramount, CBS want to not offend Trump? Because the federal government has more power than it should to stop these kinds of things from happening. And then I turn around and look at the Elizabeth Warren people of the world who are furious that Stephen Colbert is going to be canceled, even though his program was losing like $40 million a year, thinking this is to appease Trump. And like, but the Democrats also want the power, very much progressives, to oversee these kinds of mergers and acquisitions. So it doesn't really make sense to me ideologically.
Matt Welch, one of the questions that Ben Smith, who is a media reporter, but also sort of top news dog at Semaphore Media, which is a online sort of new media newsletter outlet, asked in his media report on Sunday was, is this an important moment for free speech? Seeing that these guys got a ton of money and then immediately went out and roasted both their owners and the president of the United States. What do you think?
I think for the culture of free speech, it is at least a somewhat important one, just because right now we're seeing not just Paramount, CBS, Skydance, a bunch of people bend the knee to a very aggressive Trump administration when he expresses upset or has either personally or has his agencies file a lawsuit, but also universities. And there is this sort of, what was the phrase that they used before the election, kind of preemptive self-censorship. It wasn't that.
Chilling effect is the phrase that often gets, right? Like, people don't say stuff when they're worried about getting sued.
People bend the knee. And the South Park episode, regardless of whether one finds jokes about the president having a micro penis and trying to have sex with Satan, is funny.
$1.5 billion worth of that.
But
I love it.
The act of doing that and the act of making fun of Paramount in that process, and not unimportantly, the act of doing that in an episode that absolutely is laughing about NPR being canceled and being silly and woke, and is laughing about the liberal pieties of people who have electric cars and so therefore their kids can't commit suicide in the garage, which is the best joke in the entire episode by far. But the act of that, it was just a reminder from Trey Parker, Matt Stone, that have some self-respect. Like, if you are in the culture, if you're in the media business, have some fucking self-respect. Don't bend the knee to the president of the United States. That's just unseemly. And as like a basic citizen kind of thing, to have dignity is to thumb your nose at any president, at any administration, at anyone telling you what to do. So in that respect, I think it was a nice, timely reminder that there's still a couple of people in the corporate free speech business who don't give a shit.
Catherine, Reason has a long history with South Park. We put South Park on the cover. Trey Parker and Matt Stone attended an event in Amsterdam with Reason before my time. Very sadly, I've heard great things about that for all of my time at Reason. And I was thinking about this and sort of their history. This show is almost 30 years old now, right? We're going to get this 5 more seasons. This show is incredibly popular. You do not get a $1.5 billion deal unless you are a huge, like culturally important, transformationally large hit. And so, and these guys are, I don't know if they actually explicitly call themselves libertarians, but they're pretty libertarian in their outlook, right? They gave us maybe the single best metaphor for politics, right? The giant douche versus the turd sandwich. Like, this is how libertarians understand politics. That's their theory of politics. You see so much of a kind of libertarian worldview in their show. Is South Park the most important libertarian cultural product of our lifetimes, and maybe even ever? I mean, I'm trying to think like what the comparison group is. Atlas Shrugged, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein. I mean, like it's all stuff, you know, from before you and I were alive.
Yeah, I do think sometimes people are like, who is the new Milton Friedman? Like, who is the new Friedrich Hayek? And like, I think
and it's
the
Cartman
answer
from South Park.
I think the answer is Troy Stone and Matt Parker. Like, I do. I really do. No, did I just say their names in the opposite direction?
Probably.
Those guys. And I think that's in part because of just the total kind of cultural access that they have given to the idea that like you can be against all of it. Like, the giant douche turd sandwich metaphor has helped me explain why I don't vote more than any other cultural product, more than any other individual incident, more than any terrible, you know, candidate. Like, that, just that visual, that debate stage with the characteristic South Park style says everything you need to say. And so I do think, yeah, if anything, they are probably our Milton Friedman. And that says a lot about the time that we're in. Not all complimentary, but they've done the work.
So, Robbie, to take this back to Colbert, one of the reasons that Colbert is being canceled is the show is losing $40 million a year. That's a lot of money to lose. But also, the show is losing its relevance because it had become a show for old people. If you go back in the history of late night was always a youth market, right? It was the kids who stayed up to watch the edgy humor that made fun of the president. And that's not the case, at least for Stephen Colbert anymore. That kind of humor is now on YouTube. It is now on online. It is now fragmented and sort of broken up in a way that it wasn't before. And I wonder if you think that South Park was ahead of the curve in that. And yes, they weren't on YouTube, but they were, right, like in 1997 when they launched. That's obviously something that didn't exist back then. At the same time, they were doing cheap, just in the sense of inexpensive, kind of rambunctious, youth-focused comedy that was anti-woke before we knew what anti-woke was, starting in the late 1990s. And it just seems like they were way, way ahead of their time, both in terms of their format, in terms of their sense that like you should do stuff inexpensively, and then also that you should absolutely brutally make fun of everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. We are seeing the market at work deciding what platforms, how people, younger people want to be entertained, what, you know, and that in terms of editorial choices that late night hosts make, but also the format. Do people want to listen to 5 minutes of very familiar jokes with basically a laugh track playing behind them and then go to a commercial break? I was actually thinking of this during my process last night of finding and watching the South Park episode, which I did. I have HBO Max, which has old episodes of South Park on it. And now, obviously, South Park is streaming on Paramount Plus. I don't have Paramount Plus. I have most streaming things. I don't have that one. But I do still have an honest-to-God cable subscription through the Verizon company. So I did something I haven't done in probably 2 years. I turned on like the actual television and I'm going through like the TV guide. Well, so I didn't record it. Is it possible to watch it if I didn't record it like on Comedy Central, which I have?
Wow.
And you have, there's something called like the on-demand function where you can watch it, but you cannot fast forward or rewind and you have to watch the commercials, and the commercials are for like Survivor and MTV. They haven't updated in the last 20 years. And this is, so after I finished the episode, which I thought was really good and had a lot of great jokes about the backlash to wokeness going too far, like, well, if nothing is allowed to be woke anymore, what are even we even doing with our lives? It's a real Batman and Joker dynamic. But I finished the episode and thought, I can't believe I pay $200 a month for something I can't fucking fast forward. I am going to cancel this tomorrow. This is nuts. And that is, in a nutshell, why late night and that mode of television is not going to stay with
you. A single episode of South Park has caused you right. to finally become a cord cutter.
South Park's great, but I can't watch it like that.
So. Wait, Robbie, are you the only person who still pays for a cable package on the show?
Not for much longer, Peter. Not for much longer, because it's going. But
you act like it's gonna be easy to cancel that.
Well, I mean, that's like what stops you, and it's, you know, it's tied into the, I don't know, it's like $200 a month, and it's tied into the internet service.
You have to, like, what you have to do is you call, you like punch the air a little bit, yeah. You like run up and down some stairs, and then you call, and you can, it's going to be okay.
I canceled my cable package just last year, and it was actually surprisingly easy. They've actually made some of that better. As long as you keep
your internet
package.
Is that because there's a law? There might be a law.
No, it's actually because the consumer, like reporting on this was basically the cable companies are the most hated and most difficult service, right? And they recognized this, that it was an actual problem for them, because they started facing competition from people who are just like, screw this, I'm only using my phone. So Matt Welch, I want to finish off with you here, and I want to bring this back to policy into the Trump administration. Obviously, a lot of this is adjacent to the deal, the merger that has been going through here with Skydance and Paramount, which owns CBS, of course, which is the sort of the which is Stephen Colbert's paymaster. And part of this deal appears to be that the FCC is at least saying that that CBS is going to have an ombudsman, basically like a Trump babysitter, put in place for 2 years. I'm going to read you the quote from FCC Chairman Brendan Carr, who's talking about this. One of the things they're going to have to do is put in an ombudsman in place for 2 years. So basically a bias monitor. We love bias monitors, right? That will report directly to the president. So that's something that's significant that we're going to see happening as well. Carr said the president, and it's actually unclear whether he means the president of the United States or the president of CBS or Paramount, Skydance, whatever the hell it's going to end up being. But still, is this something that you, like, how do you feel about this being a term of the deal of letting this go through?
I think Brendan Carr is a national disgrace and should resign, and if not, be chased out of office by pitchforks while the FCC is disbanded for not having any fucking reason to exist. As an opening bid, I think that Donald Trump is a self-mocking human being who signed an executive order on the first day of the presidency against censorship and saying that no element in the federal government is ever going to do the censorship ever again. Wait, hold on. I need to sue everybody and have my chairman of the FCC talk about the editorial quality and whether some people are being balanced or not in editing something or other. It's all a disgrace. And it should be a reminder to Robbie's favorite Elizabeth Warren's of the world and everybody else that when you have a federal government that's big enough to butt into commercial private transactions that have zero national interest in it. Who cares? Who's even heard of Skydance 3 years ago? The stupid name, Skydance.
I have.
Why?
They make movies.
Why did you do Skydance? all of it is rotten. And people who voted for Donald Trump, and I know some, and I think we all do, who voted for him in 2024 thinking, you know what? I'm so sick of these censorious Democrats. I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. I hope you all are having a really fun time because you were right about Democrats, but you were really, really, really wrong about Donald Trump in a way that was stone obvious long before he became president again. It is awful. It is rotten. It is censorious. And the fact that the people who have been otherwise in the free speech barricades in the other direction for a long time are kind of sitting on their hands on this is disgraceful, and they should get some dignity and self-respect and maybe draw themselves in the mirror with a micro penis and Satan.
Woo! I like it when Matt wakes up like this in the morning. This is my favorite Matt.
All right, we've got more of your favorite Matt and Robbie and Catherine coming up on this very big show. We're going to talk about the across-the-board media meltdown. Did it all start with Gawker and Hulk Hogan? And then Trump's trying to ban woke AI. Any free speech concerns about that? And are we headed for a government shutdown? And is that maybe a good thing for once? All that and so much more coming up after this. Are you tossing and turning all night? Are you feeling edgy during the day? Let me tell you about CBD from CB Distillery. Millions are turning to CBD from relief because it works. In fact, over 90% of customers report better sleep with CBD. And it's not just sleep. CB Distillery offers targeted formulations for just about everything. Sleep, stress, mood, focus, pain after exercise. They even have CBD for pets. So if you have big dogs who get a little bit anxious, like me, maybe that's what they need. And it's all made with the highest quality, clean ingredients, no fillers, just premium CBD. Me, I like to sleep gummies. They help me turn things down in my brain a little bit when there's too much going on. Helps me get to sleep. With over 2 million satisfied customers and 100% money-back guarantee, CB Distillery is the source to trust. If you're struggling with sleep, stress, or other health concerns and you have not found relief, make the change, like millions are, to CBD from CB Distillery. For a limited time, you can save 25% off your entire purchase. Visit CB Distillery and use promo code REASON. That's cbdistillery.com, promo code REASON, cbdistillery.com. Specific product availability depends on individual state regulations. Okay, beyond South Park, this seems like a very strange time for media with meltdowns and controversies everywhere. And I weirdly think that a lot of it goes back to Hulk Hogan. Yes, the professional wrestler, the guy who rips his shirt, I think even sometimes at like Republican rallies, right? He passed away last week, but his legacy includes a lawsuit that basically killed the upstart internet publication Gawker after they published a sex tape of Hogan and another man's wife without Hogan's permission. So Robbie, I want to start with you. The crucial question in the Gawker case, I don't know if you remember this, but this came when one of the lawyers asked an editor of Gawker who had published the piece in question, if there was a scenario in which he would not have published a sex tape. And he responded, if they were a child. And the lawyer followed up, well, is there a certain age, right? And he just goes, if they were four. And that was the moment when they lost the jury. And you can, like, even regardless of what you think of the merits of the free speech argument versus privacy here, you can understand why that attitude lost the jury. And to me, this was a turning point in demonstrating, like, just the huge distrust gap between normal people and the media. Like, do you think that this is sort of a, like, a, I don't know, a turning point in our media history that still matters today?
It's certainly relevant given what Donald Trump is trying to do with a lot of the media. This was a lawsuit filed by Hulk Hogan, but paid for, we learned years later, by Peter Thiel, who is seeking revenge on Gawker. Gawker was in many ways reprehensible. The conduct of the people who worked there was reprehensible. The Hulk Hogan sex tape publication was not even close to the worst thing they did. They also they outed a non-public figure in a revengey kind of way. They published the sex tape of a woman who had been assaulted, I believe, at a sports game. She was intoxicated, and there was some question whether she was being taken advantage of in a restroom. Not a public person at all, and they obtained that and published it. And when her father begged them to take it down, they said, no, you just need to deal with this. It's a question of, like, what a moral, sound judgment kind of editorial media organization should be doing that was way off there. But, you know, that's different from what the legal standard should necessarily be. We're all, I'm like most of you, extremely in favor of free speech. I think particularly in the kind of revenge porn category or the invasion of privacy or publishing people's photos and videos without their consent, there is probably room for some, in some cases, legislative action or new policy as new technologies develop. We didn't have the, you know, capability to easily record people at every moment of their lives and share it without their permission. I think that's an okay avenue to say, for even libertarians to say, well, maybe something has to be done here. But on the merits at the time, his case was probably not, should have been won by him, but he was up against some just awful people and he won and it changed the media forever, as you alluded to.
Yeah. Matt, so I have two questions for you. And the first one is, should Gawker have lost in court, just on the merits? Because the argument there, basically, for people don't remember the case, was Gawker said, this is true, and it is in the public interest because Hulk Hogan is a public figure. And not only that, but he has talked about his sex life on the show of the shock jock whose wife he was sleeping with. He is like, he
whose
has
name
made
is-
this.
Bubba the Love Sponge.
Yes.
It's whose important name to say that as Bubba, often as possible.
Bubba the Love Sponge, which definitely sounds like a South Park character. And Hogan had already made his sex life and his escapades like part of the public record and part of his public persona as a famous person. So my first question is, should Gawker have lost? But then my second question for you, Matt, is to go back to what Robbie is saying about these are awful people who did awful things. Are we better off without Gawker?
So I'll answer the first one by what I answered to Nick Denton, who's a longstanding friend of mine for 30 years, founder of Gawker, when he was trying to gin up interest at Reason to be like an ally in the lawsuit. It's like, this is an obvious open and shut free speech case. And I said to him, I don't know, man. I don't know.
Wow.
I'm not sure that's true.
You got paid for that analysis, huh?
I don't know. Really? Okay. You obtained this private thing. And I don't know. It might have some implications. And but I mean, I meant that then, and I mean it now, in a true spirit of agnosticism. I didn't do the work to figure out the exact perfect free speech. I'm sure Jesse Walker would say, of course, it was bad, and et cetera. I think that it is okay to have a little bit, just a tiny little bit of potential redress of even of public figures when the media do them dirty. And this would be right up against the line. I would note that AJ Delario, who's the guy in question in court who said the thing about the four-year-old, this reporting came out during the obit season on Hulk Hogan. He wrote Hulk Hogan a nice note afterwards and said, dude, I'm sorry. I acted like a jerk. And Hulk wrote him, Terry Bollea wrote him back something nice too. So it's important to know that there's always an option for grace and we should seek it and get better. I think that Gawker, Robbie is, you know, as usual, right about most everything. And it became a reprehensible publication. But it's interesting, I think, that it wasn't at all when it became, as far as I was concerned. It had, and people like Nick Denton, who was a great journalist before he started it, but also specifically in the people that he picked. It was these talented kind of outsiders who were desperate to be on the ins, but they were kind of unhirable. And so their jabs at the mainstreams that they were pointing at was done out of kind of this really interesting kind of needy desire to be accepted, but inability to be accepted. Elizabeth Spires was like that. I wouldn't say that she's like that to this day. My friend Ken Lane, who's there, Anna Marie Cox, some of these early people were really interesting. They were very, very talented people, all of them. The people in the next generation were not. I think what Gawker represents is not us falling out of love with the media and no longer trusting them. We've had way too much that went under the bridge before any of that. The WMMDs in Iraq, among many, many others, Dan Rather's, you know, typographies and kerning. There's just so many. Robbie has reported on 75 of them. I think what Gawker represented was the next generation that followed that initial very talented generation who had chops, they just happened to be outsiders, were people who didn't have chops, who weren't good journalists. They were just mean girls. They were just mean girls flinging acid at people constantly and then being very uppity and looking down their nose on anyone who would say, suggest that there's anything like decorum that should be decorum, right? Catherine, did I get that right?
I know that one's wrong, and I mispronounce things all the time.
Just trying to see if Robbie's awake, and I know he is because of Rising. I think Gawker became the symbol of kind of woke, mean woke media. And everybody, turns out, hates that, except for people who used to work for Gawker. And even half of them are kind of, I'm not sure, including probably Dick Denton. I don't think it's a big thing in media, but like it became caught up in the woke stuff particularly.
Rebelled against Nick Denton.
Absolutely.
And when he tried to impose very reasonable guardrails on them, like the publication had no guardrails whatsoever, which allowed it to do some interesting, in some cases, work in journalism and cultivate a very cool vibe and an interesting comment section, but also then make horrific mistakes a couple times. And when Nick Denton tried to say, okay, well, I support, 98% of what my team's doing, but you can't do this again, and we're going to undo this, they said, fuck you, man. We hate you. We will destroy you. And he's like, well,
They didn't just say it. They published this.
They published an article that said that.
And that, by the way, absolutely was one of the kind of early internet age versions of the newsroom ending up running the show despite the wishes of founders, despite the wishes of senior people. I think like what happened at Gawker just like happened in a slow burn way at like Vox later on, and it was, I think that was something that newsrooms have revolted before, certainly in previous eras of media as well. But that was a special case. I actually do think, though, like we've dwelled quite a bit on how kind of gross, especially late stage Gawker was. But, first of all, early stage Gawker was delightful. Second, that is clearly the kind of gross, the vast majority of which, if not all of which, can and should have been dealt with by market trends. And I just think that's like something that's really important to keep in mind. Like, this was not a website that needed to be killed by the state or by the law or even in court, although better that than, by presidential action or whatever, which seems to be where we are now.
It wasn't killed by the state. It was body slammed by Hulk Hogan.
Okay.
Peter Thiel, paying for the...
But they used the tools of the courts. I mean, they did it through a government mechanism. And I think that's really important. In the same way that all these mergers, we're talking about all these media mergers, and people are like, what if it gets too big and then it's expensive and bad programming? It's like, there's a way to discipline that. And it's not Brendan Carr.
Right, because Trump suing George Stephanopoulos because he thinks he was defamed is different. I mean, it's not good because Trump is himself the president and he shouldn't be doing that kind of thing. But you are allowed to bring a suit of that nature is fundamentally categorically different from what Brendan Carr is doing, or the idea that Paramount has to just, be wary of its content because the regulators are going to approve this deal, might not like it. That's the worst kind. That's just jawboning. It's fundamentally the same thing as what Republicans complained about for years about various Democratic officials, including Joe Biden himself, saying Facebook is killing people because I don't like its COVID misinformation policies. And if it doesn't change those, we're going to be looking pretty closely at Section 230 changes and you won't like them. And so fall in line, Facebook. It's categorically the same thing as what many Republicans Trump are doing now.
I think that's a good place to transition to our next segment. Since we're talking about, since you mentioned your friend Nick Denton, Matt Welch, my understanding, you may know better than me, is that he is working on an AI journalism product of some sort.
I'm not at liberty to discuss.
Okay, so this is just what I've read on the internet. I don't know. It might be totally fake. It might have been hallucinated by AI.
God help us if Matt is the AI.
This is Welch version 2.0.
At least I'm artificial.
But I bring this up because last week there was a Donald Trump executive order about woke AI. The order would, according to the Wall Street Journal, dictate that AI companies getting federal contracts be politically neutral and unbiased in their AI models. This is an effort to combat what the administration officials see as liberal bias in some models, right? So, Robbie, is this something that we need to worry about? There was, in fact, a hilarious week or so where Google's Gemini was generating images like exclusively of Black people historically in contexts where they really didn't fit. Like if you were like, hey, show me a Nazi, it would be like, here's Black Hitler. It was like early Kanye West, not exactly right. But like, it's not a completely imagined problem, right?
Yeah, it's an issue that market forces, going back to what Catherine was saying earlier, have proven completely adequate to handling. After they, right, they did that Gemini thing that, right, would not, had some laughable, hilarious, wouldn't show you like a white person at all. And it was bad. And so they changed it. Elon Musk tweaked Grok a few weeks ago to be like more politically incorrect. And Grok became a Nazi before our very eyes. And then he fixed it. Like the market is working. The last thing you need is for the government to try to dictate these rules. I mean, it goes to what we're talking about with South Park and everything. The experience of the last several years is that woke is a massive loser in the marketplace. So except in a couple sectors of our lives, which are very immune from market forces, like the higher education system or actual government employment or whatever, some places where there's still going to be remnants of wokeism or DEI or whatever we call it, things that are rigorously subjected to market forces, that thing everyone on the right hates is like losing out. So I don't have a lot of fear of some woke AI takeover, nor, and then frankly, would it be the government's job to manage that even if it was a legitimate fear. Now, I what I'm hearing is that AI industry people are pretty happy about this executive order, the rest of it, and how it will, you know, allow for more regulation, more innovation in this space, prevent regulatory stranglehold. I think that's really great and really important. This is just kind of a, you know, unnecessary and probably against our first principles aspect of it.
Matt Welch, any free speech concerns here? It is just an order that says basically, well, you're not going to get a federal contract if the federal government decides that you violate their woke AI standard, whatever it ends up being. It's not you can't develop a woke AI. It's, well, you just can't get money from the federal government, which does, in fact, have to make contracting decisions.
I'm old enough to remember when on Capitol Hill, it was seen as a big idea to have the states, the federal government, enforce the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit by withholding federal highway funds. And libertarians and conservatives and just people who had a brain on their shoulders, including a lot of Democrats, were like, what are you doing? This is federal government. What are you doing? This is state policy. Even if there is an interstate highway system, should be able to set this policy on the state and local level. I recognize that I am an adherent to a faith that is dead. And I don't care. I'm tired of the federal government sitting there and saying, kiss my ring, respect my authority, or else I'm going to withdraw my money for your university, for your state, for this, for some fucking AI regulatory policy on the state. No. Just stop it. Stop having the ring kissed. Occasionally, yes, the wielder of the ring is going to point it in this direction in a way that you like. And then you are going to have to say, well, you know, this is a mixed bag. And it is. But also stop the federal government becoming a ring kissing exercise and just get the government out of most of the sort of penny ante decision making and the throwing of federal contract money. Just knock it off. I think AI has been doing pretty well in Silicon Valley and machine learning and all of that for a good solid decade and a half before this now became the subject of federal panic and then federal policy. So I don't like it. Even if the mechanism is used for a thing I directionally like, I hate it all. I hate it. Stop having this be doling out of rewards and favors and punishments to people that you like or dislike in the name of some like momentary expedient politics.
So, Catherine, final question on this. Chris Rufo of the Manhattan Institute, scourge of woke academia and woke everywhere, took a victory lap, said basically that he had had some involvement along with David Sachs, who was Trump's AI czar, in crafting this order, and said, like, this is a good thing. This is going to stop these companies from doing stupid stuff. And especially it's going to stop the federal government from having any involvement with, like, weird leftist ideas, right, in AI. Do you see this as a sort of, I don't know, rampant Rufoism? This is the playbook that he has been using, that he has been promoting for several years now. And he's been fairly successful with this over the last few months under the Trump administration, where he's basically said, if you want to stop the liberal hegemony in the sort of in the cathedral of culture, right, and of cultural power, then you have to use the power of the federal government, which the right now has, thanks to Trump. You have to push back somehow or another. This is the way to do it.
I recommend to listeners a debate that we ran in the magazine a while back between Todd Zwicky and Kent Lastman about this very question. Basically, When is it ever acceptable to sort of seize power in order to do libertarianism? And I think they're both smart guys and they really articulate both sides of this genuinely difficult question pretty well. I do come down on the side, especially with respect to anything that's tech or media adjacent, that any kind of like legislative or executive action will almost always be a lagging, not a leading indicator. And so this is a great example of like, great, cool. We finally got this order, which is solving a problem that Gemini solved months and months and months ago. And that happens over and over. Like, oh, we're going to have an ombudsman who's going to sit in on coverage decisions at a giant, you know, Skydance, Paramount, whatever the heck corporation. Like, that person is going to be solving problems that existed 3 years before with an onslaught of paperwork. I think this happens everywhere. This just happens everywhere with tech. And it's far, far better to keep, you know, to keep the government out of it. But there really is this legitimate problem of, you know, the RUFOs of the world are going to want to claim credit for solving a problem that was already mostly solved and now will be locked in, made worse, distorted by like a late breaking government action.
This week's listener question comes from Augusto, who writes, now that Trump's BBB, the Big Beautiful Bill, has been signed, I hear many pundits saying that this bill will only generate small growth. I hear the rationale and it sort of makes sense, but so far I've not seen much discussion around whether this bill or this administration has done a good job to deregulate the economy. How would the panel evaluate what Trump has deregulated so far with BBB or through the federal agencies and executive orders? Thank you, Augusto, for a great question. Matt Welch, during Donald Trump's first term, you wrote a cover story calling Trump the deregulator in chief, but there was a question mark. So it was a question.
Thank you.
Answer that question once again, now that we're 6 months or so into Trump's second term.
He, as that piece pointed out, was already exceeding expectations, pre-election expectations in 2017 for how committed he was going to be at making some deregulatory steps. Note that that's not the same as being a huge deregulator or achieving a lot of deregulation. So he instituted the 2-for-1 rule. He had to get rid of two regulations for every one new one adopted. And they kind of used it. And he took some deregulatory actions at the FDA and some other places that was legit, and talks always in the State of the Union addresses about, you know, right to try and things like that. The reason's been banging on for 5 decades. However, to give a sense of the answer, which is very similar to the Gawker lawsuit answer of like, I don't know, man, is that when you're talking
about
just the
bringing the heat today.
Well, no, I'm bringing the humility in the face of gigantic government action. It's a big, beautiful bill, obviously not beautiful, certainly really big. And there's so many elements to it that it's very, very hard to give an up or down like scorecard assessment. And I'm going to illustrate that point by reading some headlines from our deregulatory friends over at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, where the aforementioned Kent Lastman is doing wonderful work. These are just a handful. Deregulation deferred, not defeated. By the big, beautiful bill. Okay, that sounds like suboptimal. Senate poised to start undoing green subsidies in big, beautiful bill. Thumbs up. Senate big, beautiful bill contains needed Medicaid reforms. Cool. Big, beautiful bill threatens the Costco of healthcare. Thumbs down. Like, there's so many things in it that it's really, really hard to make a single assessment. And that's part of the problems of these big cromnibus like bills that we get crammed through that people don't ever read until they're passed. And they contain a lot of subdivisions and sub paragraphs, parentheses written by lobbyists in one direction or the other. It makes it very, very difficult. The Competitive Enterprise Institute publishes an annual thing called the 10,000 Commandments that talks about the regulatory state and agencies. It's 2025 edition, which came out in April, says that we are setting a new mark this year for regulatory costs at north of $2.155 trillion. Trump is way better than Biden on deregulating. However, deregulation happens with Congress, and nothing about the modern Congress, the modern Republican Party, the modern separation of powers has Republicans in Congress, deregulators in Congress, which used to be Democrats as well, doing a goddamn thing about deregulation. So what you have instead is that whoever is president gets to use the pen and the phone to directionally point it here. And then the next one undoes it and points it over there. And we get half excited this way and half excited that way. And basically the regulatory state continues to increase. Final point on this is that, as our friends at CEI will point out, racking up gigantic government debts is bad on regulations. And also tariffs and immigration restrictions are super duper regulatory. They are the federal government telling you what you can and cannot do and how much it's going to cost. Industrial policy is by definition regulatory. So Trump, who has now introduced tariffs at a rate we haven't seen in one century since Franklin Delano Roosevelt, is not going to be a deregulatory president in the net, because he's adding all of this regulatory fat everywhere.
Yeah. So the question was specifically about the big, beautiful bill. And I just want to sort of focus on one aspect of it, or sort of one process part of the big, beautiful bill, which was this was a reconciliation bill. And reconciliation bills are bills that can get through the Senate on 50 votes plus one, which is how it got through. And reconciliation bills are, by rule, not really allowed to be deregulatory. They have to be just about fiscal matters. Now, sometimes the government effectively regulates through the tax code. As Matt mentioned, there's a lot of subsidies, right? And those subsidies kind of function like regulations because they are either tax breaks or money going towards a specific action. They're basically saying you're going to get money or not get money if you do or don't do X. And so it kind of functions like a regulation does, which is saying either you have to do something or you can't do something. But then I think the other thing to think about here is just the point that Matt made. On the one hand, is Donald Trump deregulating? It's a difficult question to answer. On the other hand, how is Donald Trump doing compared to the alternative, Kamala Harris? Kamala Harris would have done a whole lot of regulating, not deregulating, by now. And on that, like just in that, just making that comparison between the two, Donald Trump is almost certainly better. All right, we're just going to move on here. Reminder, we love to answer your questions. Indeed, we enjoy it so much. We are actually answering even more of your questions on YouTube in a little segment we call Table for Two. It'll be out later this week at the Reason Roundtable YouTube channel. You should subscribe and watch our videos. If you have a question for the Reason Roundtable, submit your short, succinct, pithy, and not very long query to podcasts@reason.com. That is podcasts@reason.com. Let's move on to a question that we ask at the end of every summer. Is there a government shutdown maybe on the horizon? Well, we're coming up on September, the end of which is the end of the government's fiscal year. So maybe, probably, in March, a handful of mostly moderate Democrats joined Republicans to help pass a spending bill that kept the government open. That made a lot of rank and file Democrats and activists mad. And now they're even more mad because of the Doge rescissions bill. So The Democrats are currently really upset because of these $9 billion in cuts through the Doge bill, because they were like, well, we agreed on all this spending and then you took it back, right? The rescissions bill basically meant they unagreed to it because of a push from Trump. Catherine, I've often argued against government shutdowns because they're counterproductive. They don't really save us any money. They don't really get us any of the goals that we're looking at. But in this case, a shutdown might actually let Trump and White House Budget Director Russ Vogt just like stop a bunch of things from happening. Here is a quote from Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman that I just want you to react to. President Trump could literally just mass fire everyone during a shutdown now, and the Supreme Court would probably back much of that. Don't ever shut the government down. I take it you feel the opposite.
Yeah, I remain maybe against my better judgment, certainly against the example of recent history, a teeny bit fond of government shutdowns. I just feel like it's always a good reminder to people that the government can shut down and life can continue. It shuts down less and less. Government shutdowns aren't what they used to be, just to be the grandpa of this moment in this podcast.
But I remember when government...
It did genuinely used to be that more of the government shut down, more ground to a halt. There was more kind of actual shenanigans on the Hill, and that we just didn't have the kind of ritual in place that we have now, where it's almost like kabuki shutdown.
But this is the point that Fetterman is trying to make, is that in this case, it might not be kabuki. It right. might so, be that in the absence of government funding, Donald Trump could just decide we're not going to do a bunch of stuff for as long as the government stays shut down.
That's my hope for shutdowns springing eternal. And I think that unfortunately, the thing is, you know, Fetterman obviously has his own agenda and saying like the Supreme Court would probably let him do it. I'm not so sure. I do think he could fire a bunch of people or do other stuff. And then we would have to process it through the courts just like we are processing everything through the courts, which is taking an increasingly long time. And that is not at all the same as a Javier Milei style, slash and burn. Which, of course, is what I would like to see in real life.
Matt Welch, I want to read you a quote from Senator Patty Murray, who's the top Democrat on the Appropriations Committee. She says, "It is no secret the path to advancing more of our bills is going to be harder because of the unprecedented partisan rescissions bill." That's the DOGE cuts that Republicans just passed. "It's extremely frustrating to see that so many of the colleagues that have worked with us to pass funding bills turn around and vote to rip away the funding that we all agreed on." Another quote, this time from Chuck Schumer, "They shouldn't be doing rescissions, plain and simple." What does it say about our fiscal situation that this measly $9 billion spending trim, just the tiniest fraction of federal spending, has made Democrats so upset?
Just boo frickety who, like are you kidding? I think in this case they reveal themselves not with a number, but the rescission is literally we agreed to this spending before, now we're unagreeing, and so their feelings are hurt that there's an unagreeing, and then they will probably notice that when they supported some bill, kind of like Josh Hawley recently did with the Big Beautiful Bill, you support it because you have to. It's the Cromnibus. It's up or down vote. And then you're going to immediately introduce a new bill to undo the part in the big one that you voted yes for that you didn't like because of politics and et cetera. Everyone does this. There's just no appetite for seriousness on Capitol Hill right now. And I look forward to anyone pretending at least to be serious about budgetary matters, about like passing budgets on time and doing that instead of an annual December, 21st brinksmanship, got to sign it, got to not thing going forward. It's hard to take any of these people seriously. And meanwhile, the national debt is hitting north of around $37 trillion right now. And we're spending more on debt service than we are on the military. So congratulations.
Yeah, I could understand some of the complaints that people had about some of the stuff DOGE was doing at the very beginning of the Trump presidency, where it did seem like in some cases, maybe DOGE was cutting legal corners, doing stuff that wasn't like obviously strictly legal. But the rescissions bill was totally legal and constitutional. There's absolutely no argument that it was not kosher in any way. And Democrats are just throwing a fit over $9 billion, $9 billion, which is like nothing in the grand scheme of the federal budget. Robbie, I just want to finish out here with you. Are Democrats actually upset about this? Like, are they really mad, or are they just playing to an activist base that never wants to see one single dollar cut from federal spending? Because this is what the Democratic groups exist to do, is to say, spend at least this much and maybe more on the thing that we care about forever.
Yeah, the Democratic base is really unhappy with their leadership. Particularly leadership, they're unhappy with
Gawker staffers in that way.
Yeah, they want them to do something, but it's not clear what they should do or what their policy direction should be. There's a lot of kind of insider Democratic battling over should it be more economic populism or even sort of like socialist Zohran Mamdani type thing, just because he's kind of a charismatic person who's doing well for himself. Is that the national policy? Is it going to be a wonky Ezra Klein abundance type thing that I think would be good policy, but whether that would be like a sexy platform for the Democratic Party is an entirely different question. They have no actual leader right now because we're in the lull between, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and whatever comes next. It might be Kamala Harris, might be somebody else. So they have nothing and they're frustrated and they're out of power and they want their party to do something and there's nothing for them to do. And it is true that while we all love the idea of cutting government spending, then when you start to be specific about entitlements, you then see public opinion polling start to move. Like, yes, I want government cut radically. I want less of that, you know, foreign aid. But how dare you touch my Social Security or my Medicare? That is, I think, increasingly part of the Democratic coalition. We used to think of older Americans as being more conservative and Republican. It seems to be the Republican Party absorbed a lot of younger voters in the last election. And by extension, the Democratic Party is more older focused in a kind of generational, who's concerned about the debt, who's going to have to deal with that. I think the Democratic Party is a little bit more built into it.
It was Donald Trump who, more than any other Republican, certainly in the last 20 years, took entitlement cuts off the table, at least for Social Security and for Medicare. Yes, there was a big trim to future planned Medicaid spending in the BBB, but Donald Trump has been out there for a decade now saying the Republican Party will not meaningfully cut Medicare or Social Security.
Well, Suderman, to quote a favorite movie of mine, looks like meat's back on the menu, boys.
That's the ring that Matt was talking about earlier. Yeah, I'm the future of the Democratic Party. They're not going to choose between Ezra Klein and Zoran Mamdani. They're going to combine the two. It's going to be like this movie that is coming out where like two lovers get like sort of David Cronenberg's morphed together into like a blob.
It's like Dog Man. It's like Dog Man.
It's going to be like Dog Man, and they're going to call it Abundance Socialism. All right, let's go on to our cultural recommendations, what we've been watching, reading, and otherwise consuming in the cultural arena this past week. Matt Welch, what do you have for us?
The National Baseball Hall of Fame Museum in beautiful Cooperstown, yes! New York, has a brand new exhibit about the history of Japanese baseball. It's a beautifully bilingual exhibit. It's gorgeous. It's really fun, interesting, as all things you can imagine, exports of American stuff. It begins with a USS naval ship and kind of goes on from there. But a fascinating history of cultural exchange dating back to the 1870s and being crowned in many ways this weekend, literally yesterday, at their annual Hall of Fame induction ceremony, at which Ichiro Suzuki, the marvelous Ichiro Suzuki, was inducted in the Hall of Fame, first Japanese-born American player to be so enshrined. And his speech, I can't recommend it highly enough to go and watch. It's super hilarious in every way, shape, and form. But the exhibit itself is great. Next time you go to Cooperstown, check it out. Third floor, going to be up there for a while. Beautiful Shohei Ohtani, reigning most valuable player. Stuff in there and great things about Lefty O'Doul. And probably my favorite bit, which I had no idea about, is that there is something in Japanese baseball lore called the Curse of KFC. And it involves a statue of Colonel Sanders being drowned in a canal and therefore cursing a team because that was the only thing that they had as a stand-in for the one American player on the team. And it doesn't make any sense. It's bananas and I love it.
Okay. I don't have any follow-ups. Nope. I just want to know what Robbie has for us. What annoying, incredibly nerdy stats game have you been playing?
I have something kind of normal for me, and especially compared to what we just heard. So I was on vacation in Sicily recently. So I watched a lot of terrible movies on the plane. I won't go into those because I think Suderman would fight me on half of them. But I did something I don't do very much now, which is I bought a physical book to read with me, like while I was sitting in the pool. I mostly listen to audiobooks. And I picked up Circe, which is Greek mythology, Madeline Miller, author of the book Song of Achilles, which is better known, which I read a couple of years ago and really liked. Periodically, like every couple of years, I remember how much I love Greek mythology. But what was so perfect about reading this book is that I was in Sicily, and you might think, if you're not overly familiar with the narrative, that I should have been in the Greek Isles reading it. But in fact, Circe, who is this sea witch from Greek mythology who deals with Odysseus and the Minotaur and some other things, she is exiled to an island that might have been Sicily or might have been near to Sicily because she's very involved in that the Scylla and Charybdis, the strait where you have to navigate, where there's a sea monster on one side and a maelstrom on the other. And that is plausibly Sicily and mainland Italy, the narrow strait Messina that connects them. So I felt like I was reading it in the perfect locale, and it was a great book. I highly recommend it to anyone who has a Greek mythology interest. They incorporate Odysseus, and my favorite part was the Minotaur sort of showdown is great. So highly recommend.
That's also plausibly our next map for our D&D adventure, right? I mean,
a lot
this
of
is
D&D,
exactly...
D&D ideas. Actually, the major D&D innovation is that I went to the art store the other day and I bought actual poster boards, and I went to a professional art store and I'm like, please show me to the Crayola aisle and I will have some really excellent third grade level art for our next session.
Wow.
Okay, final question for you about this. Not about the myths, but about the book itself. Was your experience with the physical technology of the book better or worse than your experience with the cable box?
Much better. It was yeah. Nice to read a book, to ruffle the paper, to get a little bit of sunscreen and chlorinated water on the pages. There's something nice about it.
Gutenberg wins again.
Yeah.
You can, in fact, fast forward the book. You just flip the pages. Catherine, what do you have for us?
I went to an arcade. My friend, Alan Carrington Brooks, who is also a one or two time Reason contributor, has opened an arcade. It's in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of D.C.
Like
it's
with called, tokens and tickets and Double Dragon?
It's called Continues, and it has a million bazillion cool vintage arcade games. They're all the ones that you played growing up. There is Skee Ball. You can rent. There's also like a restaurant and a bar, and you can get coffee and breakfast burritos. It's a whole situation there. It's pretty great. To my mind, the best bit is there are two living rooms in each corner of the restaurant area, which is like the equivalent of like if you got bottle service at the club, except for it's just an old TV with a Nintendo hooked up to it. And you can like reserve them and just go play Nintendo on a sofa with the TV in the corner of a restaurant and bar.
Does it cost $900 and it comes with like a firework on top?
I cannot speak to that question, but played a bunch of, there's pinball also. So if you could watch the Bragg Brothers pinball movie and then go to the arcade and experience that, just delightful. If you happen to have kind of elder millennial era arcade game nostalgia and be in the DC area, I recommend that you check out Continues.
I think people of a certain youth age, like, just don't understand that video games used to be something you had to go someplace to do, to play in the, like, with other people around, like at a mall. There was a whole shop that was like, is like, instead of going to the Gap, you would go and play Mortal Kombat, you would play Double Dragon, you would play Afterburner, and that there was this whole social experience. I strongly recommend, and this will help you actually for this fall, because there's a sequel coming out. If you don't understand this, go back and watch the original 1982, I believe it is, Tron, the first act of which basically takes place in Flynn's arcade. It is a great depiction of a video arcade. So not surprisingly, I watched a movie about Marvel superheroes. I'm so surprised I can't even pronounce it correctly. Fantastic Four: First Steps. So I grew up reading the Fantastic Four comics. Like, I was a big Fantastic Four nerd. It was Fantastic Four and Spider-Man. And this movie does a much better job than the previous films of capturing that kind of gee whiz retro sci-fi tone of the comics in the late 80s and early 1990s when I was reading them. But it also does a very strange thing. It uses Marvel's multiverse to position the Fantastic Four as benevolent superhero authoritarians. They're basically the UN, except sort of private and techno-futurist, and they rule over the Earth with their technological superiority and are like, you know what, you can't have war or crime or do anything bad, because if you do, we're going to take away our technology from you, and you won't want that. So basically, we're in charge now. And the movie just does this in a way that it doesn't then do anything with this. It's like, or does very little with it. There's like one kind of plot point about like, well, is the Fantastic Four going to sacrifice their child for humanity? The humans who have come to rely on them are like, maybe you should do that because there's only one of your kid and a whole lot of us. But other than that, it's just this kind of unusual setup where it's like, huh, if there were superheroes, and they were very like technologically superior, maybe they would rule over us like gods, and they'd be good and they'd be fine and it'd be okay. And then we're just not going to question that at all. And it's such an odd contrast after having seen Superman just a couple of weeks ago, because so much of the conflict in Superman is basically about whether he should intervene in global affairs and stop a war. And the like, in the end, it's like, yes, that is the good thing to do. It actually ends up being the Justice League that intervenes in that war, not Superman. But it is, but like Superman's quest to be a good person is intimately like his central conflict in this movie is totally involved in the question of, should I stop a war from happening and stop a rogue nation basically from invading another country? And it's like, people have been like, this is about Israel or Palestine. It's not really. The movie was like written years ago before a lot of that happened. But it is kind of a neoconservative approach to Superman of like, well, he has the power to do this and therefore he should, because that's what being a good person or a good superhero is actually about. Just kind of odd to see those two things paired. And Superman, while kind of a scattered and messy movie, just ends up taking these political ideas much more seriously. All right, folks, that is our show. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you so much for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.